Okay, let's get everybody sitting down again, please. Could somebody open the door and invite anybody who's out in the hall to come back in too, please? Thanks. Thank you. Okay, to clarify the voting procedure, Lauren has a clicker for Lorian and a clicker for Christine. So that's what's happening here. So we will hopefully have 1 minute, and during that time she will poll them and we will all vote, and it should work out just fine. So that's the process we're going
to
try.
Okay, so we're back to impact, and this is measure 0252, assessment of iron stores, and we're on impact. Tanae, go ahead and start the timer. And
Lorian, you said two, moderate, correct?
Moderate, correct.
Okay. And Christine, moderate, correct?
Yes.
The total number will be 33, right?
21. 21 people voting.
Where do you see the number?
Oh, yeah.
So we're still missing some 12.
One. We have 21 people voting.
Oh, 21, 21. Okay. Just one person. You might vote again because it doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
To make sure your vote went through.
Okay. There we go. All right. There we go. Okay. So that's how it works, everybody.
And we need to read it into the record,
oh,
right?
Yes.
One high, five, moderate, 14, low, two. Nobody voted insufficient.
Okay, so I'll move on to 1B, which is opportunity for improvement. And basically, the preliminary evaluations were split between either moderate or low. And so one of the things I'll just mention in the measure submission, and Lauren, you may want to bring this up, 1B2, they provided an analysis of Crown Web data, and the distribution of scores was at the first quartile of was 97%, the median was 100%, and third quartile 100%. So there really is very little variability, and overall it looks like pretty high performance. They did present some information in 1B4 about data on disparities by different population groups, and those also look to be quite high. So that's, I think, the information on opportunity for improvement, but I'll stop there and ask for the other assigned reviewers if they want to make any comments on this, and then whether there's any discussion. One of the reviewers noted that, yes, it's high performance. Perhaps that indicates that the measure was working in terms of getting people to high performance. So I'll just ask if there are any other the assigned reviewers, and then a general discussion. Anything else from the assigned reviewers? Additional comments about that? Okay.
Is it okay to tell the panel? Or would they like to know how the other reviewers voted on this?
Yeah, you want to? Yeah.
Oh, you can see it. Okay.
Right.
Amazing. Okay.
Right. And you need to enable your macros.
Oh, okay. Well, I can do it.
Yeah, but if you.
Enable.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So the preliminary voters, two moderate, three low.
Okay.
Okay. Any discussion? Okay. Then on opportunity for improvement or performance gap, again, the scale is high, moderate, low, insufficient. And go ahead and start the timer.
And Lorian, performance gap. High, moderate, low, or insufficient?
Low.
And Christine?
Low.
So the results are 16 low, 5 moderate.
So even though all of the sub-criteria need to be passed, we're going to rate all the sub-criteria and then we'll apply the decision logic to importance and then discuss any potential for reserve status. So the next sub-criterion is about evidence. This is not an outcome measure, so we'll skip that particular question. And we'll be talking about the quantity, quality, and consistency of the evidence, and we have to look at those separately. On the quantity of evidence, the preliminary voters agreed that this was moderate or high. And maybe what we'll do, it might be easier to kind of talk about evidence in general and then rate the specific sub-criteria on evidence. See what you think about this, but it might be a little too disjointed to just vote on those separately. So on the quantity is obviously just about the number of studies, and you know, our scale is pretty generous that low would be 1 study, moderate 2 to 4, and high 5. I think the main issue that was brought up in, and then I'm just going to, sorry, in the quality of evidence, we had 2 preliminary reviewers that indicated insufficient, 2 moderate, and 1 high. We did ask the developer for some additional clarifications about the evidence, and that was in some of their responses. I think the thing to consider here is, you know, again, this is we're measuring something that's distal to the desired outcome. It's about assessing iron stores. The evidence in the additional information that was submitted talked about the evidence of treatment using iron and the ability to have lower ESA doses if you treat anemia with iron. Also, of course, they had mentioned the association between hemoglobin levels and mortality. Again, this is one of those things where it's you assess and then you diagnose, identify treatment options, administer treatment, and then effects on hemoglobin, and then ultimately on mortality or survival. So the evidence would be indirect because there's not evidence about how frequently you should measure hemoglobin. It's one of those things that's necessary but not sufficient to achieve the desired outcomes. As I mentioned earlier, this was originally in the context of also when we looked at this in the ESRD, the prior project, in the context of having a hemoglobin target measure or at least measuring patients below 10. So I'm going to stop there and ask the other reviewers to make some comments about evidence in general, and then open up to the steering committee, and then we'll actually vote on quantity, quality, and consistency. So some of the other reviewers, Lorian.
Yes, hi. So I was one of the reviewers who initially thought there was insufficient data on quality and consistency. However, supplemental data and the stewards, and I think made available to everyone that provided, I think, further substantiation of the quality and consistency of data, and they provided additional references. I'm not sure, and some of that additional data, or if everybody's had a chance, I think it is relevant to their price.
Right. And Andrew Fenvis and Rick Caskell.
Christine,
any additional comments?
No, I agree with Lori, and that was my feeling as well. I originally raised it as insufficient evidence, but I think the additional evidence that we received substantiates the measure better.
Okay. So could we have some discussion then from the steering committee in general about, the evidence that supports this measure, and
well, this is a question I have, and this applies, I think, to many of the things we're going to look at. The evidence is that it's good to treat anemia with iron, and that's a good thing, and I don't think there's much doubt about that among those of us in practice anyway, but there's no evidence saying that to measure the frequency or to make sure that the measurement is done with a certain frequency gets us there, that I read. And I have to confess, I didn't see the stuff that was submitted later. But does that bother people, or is that what we're supposed to,
Right.
We have to make that leap, or it bothers me?
Having just reviewed this for KDGO, that group has come to the conclusion that although there's a recommendation about frequency, it's ungraded, which is basically their way of saying that there's absolutely no evidence to indicate or to support a specific recommendation.
And this is Lori, and I struggle with a similar issue. I think you have to assume that if diagnosing and treating iron deficiency is important, then measuring iron stores is a necessary component of that. The frequency of which we should be doing it and which to deem this a true performance measure, I think, is very difficult.
So, I mean, this obviously is going to come up a whole bunch of times over the course of the next 2 days, and there's a lot of measures that are in the same vein. And I guess, Karen, you said it's necessary but not sufficient, and what I would like to have seen, especially given that this is now a review of an endorsed measure, is moving on to the next step of actually assessing the outcome, the thing, as opposed to the process. And I guess it leaves us as a committee sort of stuck in that we don't have that. So do we go with nothing, or do we stick with the process?
And just along those lines, the thing, though, has sort of become out of reach because of the new FDA ruling, too. So in this particular metric, it may be harder to go further. Other comments, thoughts?
This is Rick Kessler. I think it becomes important in terms of resistance to ESA. If dosing is increased, and that's an algorithm now, not just one point in time, that you would be measuring this. And I think that was the emphasis of my scoring. This is important, but again, under the purview of a resistant state, this would become even more important. We're increasing ESA dosing.
One other context issue from the recent ESRD project. You did recommend a measure that will be endorsed about actually use of iron therapy. So again, that's an intervention that's closer to desired outcomes, but that was specifically for pediatric patients.
Okay, so I think we're ready to...
Right. So I think what we need to do is rate the evidence for the measure, which is the frequency of assessment of iron stores. Once we get the ratings on importance or on this, we can then talk about whether you want to invoke the exception for expert opinion versus evidence, depending on how this comes out. So I just want to kind of lay out what the steps are going to be.
And again, just a clarification, if I could. We're voting on the evidence that the frequency of every 3 months is supported as opposed to the need to measure iron.
Okay. So we would first rate the quantity of studies in the body of evidence. And go ahead and start the timer. The rating is high, moderate, low, insufficient.
Ed Lorien, high, moderate, low, insufficient.
For quantity?
Yes.
For quantity.
Moderate.
And Christine?
Moderate.
Okay, there we go.
Results are 13 moderate, 6 low.
Okay. All right, we'll move on to...
And 2 insufficient, I'm sorry. Skip to 21. Sorry.
That's right. I'll move on to evidence, the quality of the body of evidence, and this relates to the study design, the strength of the evidence, the directness of the evidence included here. So quality of the body of evidence, again, the rating is high, moderate, low, insufficient. Go ahead and start.
And Lorian, quality?
Moderate.
And Christine?
Insufficient.
Okay, we have 2 moderate, 8 low, 9 insufficient. I'm
four,
sorry?
4
moderate. Did I say 2? Oh, I'm sorry. I'll get this right yet, or maybe someone else should read it. 4 moderate, 8 low, 9 insufficient. I should use my glasses.
Okay, and then the last one would be consistency of the evidence. High, moderate, low, insufficient.
Lorian, consistency?
Moderate.
And Christine?
Insufficient.
Results, 7 voted moderate, 4 low, 10 insufficient.
Okay. So, based on our decision algorithm, basically we have mostly lows and insufficient for the, you want to just show for the quantity, there we go. Quantity was fine, but then
but it didn't make quality or inconsistency.
Okay.
So
right. So it basically would not pass evidence. It also did not pass opportunity for improvement. So let's move on to the next slide. So the question about evidence is we do have an exception for measures based on expert opinion. If the committee really thinks that a measure on this topic should be considered further. We would like to see that expert opinion have been systematically assessed since it's in a guideline. I think that's probably the case, with agreement that benefits to patients greatly outweigh harms. Obviously, there's I won't say that. You would be in better position to judge benefits over harms. So I guess the first question is there anyone on the committee that wants to have a discussion about whether this measure warrants further discussion in terms of a need for this type of measure and whether you want to invoke the expert opinion exception?
Well, it's hard to believe that this metric causes more harm, a lot of potential harm, although, again, that's, it is certainly possible, unintended consequences.
The other issue is, because we're arguing about intervals, right, I can't foresee a study that's ever going to be done or funded comparing, say, 1 month, 3 months, 6 months. It just won't happen, so we can, we'll have to evolve some opinion, I don't think.
think this is one of those measures that, or one of these items that falls into the realm of it's probably good clinical practice, but maybe doesn't require public reporting.
I think it's also one of the measures there's no performance gap when you look at the intervals and the performance gap as it was related here. It's actually happening, and so without the gap and there's no room for improvement, I'm not sure that, you know, clearly there's no harm, but there may not be any benefit to continue.
And along that line, one of the criteria we looked at, has the outcome improved in the last 3 years when this metric's been in place, and I would be surprised, but do we have any information on that?
Well, actually, and that's where I know it would come up under validity, but probably maybe we should put it in the context of this discussion about whether you want to invoke expert opinion and reserve status for a performance measure. But in the validity section under 2B, so maybe you want to pull that up. Okay, so if we look at 2B 2.3, 2B2 is about validity testing. And so what Arbor did is they looked at quintiles of performance on this measure, assessing iron score, and looked at it in relationship to performance on the mortality measure that they have. And basically showed that there was an association with the two lowest performance measure quintiles had higher risk, those facilities had a higher risk of mortality. Lower performance on this assessment measure was associated with higher risk of mortality. But it was really just a difference of the lowest two quintiles. Of course, that's because performance was so high to begin with. So I just wanted to point that out in case that factored into any of your decisions.
But they didn't directly report on here's where it was 3 years ago and it was only at 90% compliance and now it's at 99. They didn't have any data like that.
But this is kind of a, that may come up again though. What if there was a measure that was endorsed and the performance gap closed and now there isn't? So then do you now no longer endorse that because there's no longer a performance gap? I mean, if we assume that that changed practice, then I'm just so I understand properly, because then you have to assume, or is there going to be some periodicity that people will assume that these will be revisited in the future? And then if the performance gap were to evolve again, then we would come back to it? I mean, I'm just trying to think.
And that's where we have that reserve status to continue endorsement under reserve status. If it's a, you know, so the question is if you think that this measure merits that, we would continue the evaluation to see if all the criteria are met for that. Okay.
While we're thinking about it, I guess we should have Dr. Narva introduce himself. Does he have a disclosure of interest form? Okay. Are you prepared? Here's our list of things to just say briefly so that you can join the committee. I'm Andy Narva. I direct the National Kidney Disease Education Program at the NIH in Bethesda, Maryland. I'm interested in improving care for people with CKD in the primary care setting. That's the major focus of our program. My major non-medical interest right now is my three-year-old son, and I don't have any disclosures. Welcome, Dr. Narva. Okay. So,
So
we're going to vote on whether we want to kind of override our last decision and continue this anyway. Is that what we're voting on?
So So let's go ahead, and I think there's enough discussion about it. Let's go ahead and vote on this question, which is the exception for empirical evidence based on the...
Well, are we voting that we're going to... I may have confused the issue. Are we voting that the benefits outweigh the harms, or are we going to vote to continue this despite the fact...
Well, we first have to vote on this issue of empiric, using a measure based on expert opinion, if you agree that that's okay, and then we will talk about the reserve status, right?
So the question is...
Well, the way the question is worded here is differently.
Yeah, we want to continue this measure given the lack of empiric evidence.
So basically what we said is that there's really no empirical evidence, it's expert opinion. And is the expert opinion such that the benefits to patients greatly outweigh potential harms?
Okay. That's the question.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. So the options are yes and no, that the benefits outweigh harms.
I'm sorry. This is Lori. Can you just... question that we're to answer yes or no to?
Restate the
question.
Okay,
the question is, there's no empirical evidence and expert opinion was systematically assessed with agreement that benefits to patients greatly outweigh potential harms, and it's judged that by this committee that the benefits to patients clearly outweigh potential harms.
It's also section 1C on the submission form.
And if the responses are yes or no.
Okay. Can you clarify the consequences of this vote, please? If we vote yes, then this...
Then we'll just be able to continue and discuss whether we want to consider this for reserve status. Okay. If the answer is no, we'll just end here because it... Okay. All right, sorry.
Okay, go ahead and start the vote.
Okay, so Lorian, yes or no?
I'm going to say no.
And Christine, yes or no?
Yes.
Thank you.
And now we need 22 votes.
Yeah, 22 votes. Okay.
Andy, are you voting on this? Okay.
Okay,
all right.
Stop there.
Okay, stop it.
Results, 16 yes, 5 no.
Okay, so let's move on to the next slide, Janae. So basically, we still have a measure that did not pass performance gap or importance opportunity for improvement. So let's go on to the next slide. So it came up, do we want to consider this for potential for reserve status? If so, it means we will continue to assess reliability and validity. If not, if you think, it's still not going to be, because there is no performance gap, but, it's not going to be that useful for continuing for potential for reserve status. And so we want, the question is whether this even meets our criteria for reserve status, isn't it? Because it's not proximal to desired outcome. There's no strong direct evidence. It's just expert opinion. It's obviously related. So I don't know. What do you think?
I think it's a close call. I think it's really up to this group to really who knows the evidence best to make that assessment. I mean, to me, as a general insurance, it seems somewhat analogous to the fact that we look at the levels of A1C control in diabetics. There is a measure that looks at the, did you measure A1C levels? That's sort of, I think, also moving its way out of fashion and moving more towards just looking at the outcome. I think that's the decision the group needs to make. Is there still value in the assessment measure when you can also look at the intermediate outcome?
Right. Yes. Right. Yes. So we're still at the point of, you know, it's important to do in clinical practice. Is it something that you want to consider for reserve status?
Just to qualify that, it's really a reporting of the assessment, right? So it's still not getting at the...
Okay. Oh.
Yes.
I just, Joe Masana from UMKech, just wanted to make sure in the performance gap discussion, there was some difference between the results for hemodialysis and peritoneal dialysis patients, 97 versus 86%, and whether that would influence the discussion of whether there was a performance gap for a subset of patients.
Okay. So the vote then is whether we're going to grant this reserve status.
Well, whether we'll continue evaluating.
Continue evaluating.
We decide it till the end. Otherwise, it'll stop here.
The potential for reserve status.
Right.
And again, sorry, if it's in reserve status, it means that it's not in active use, but it's out there for the future in case the performance gap widens. But how do we know if the performance gap widens if it's not in active use?
So the idea would be that there'd be some ongoing surveillance with not public reporting periodically to make sure performance doesn't fall down, but it may not rise to the level of what we think are the importance of other measures with a known gap. Again, this is relatively new for us. Handful of measures have been put into reserve status to date as part of the cardiovascular committee. And again, very similar sorts of discussions. And really, the idea would be that the measure would not have to go through a full endorsement later when it comes up for maintenance in 3 years. It can be a discussion that says, actually, the background surveillance, they've got this on Crown Web anyway, would suggest, actually, there has been a decrement of performance. Maybe we should move it back up to active use.
Just in context, though, I think those cardiovascular measures were mainly interventions, not assessment measures. Right. I said they were intervention measures. So what's an example of one of them?
So aspirin use, for example, in context of AMI, it's hard to walk into any emergency department in America without an aspirin in your mouth. So, things like that,
right,
or what the cardiovascular committee considered. I will tell you that the appetite for assessment measures is one that always gets complicated when they go through the process.
Further discussion on, okay, so what we're voting on now is whether you want to continue looking at this measure for potential reserve status, yes or no. Okay, start the timer.
And Lorian, yes or no, reserve status?
No.
And Christine, yes or no?
Yes.
One more person.
Oh, that last vote. Okay, we have 10 yes and 11 no. Who is that?
Okay, so we will actually stop on this measure here. It would not go forward to be recommended. When something like this is a fairly close vote, we kind of highlight that in the draft report, and then we'll see what kind of comments we get. That you would have the potential to reconsider that, but at this point, our votes are based on majority vote. But we'll definitely note that in the draft report. Okay. So, I know it feels like we're a little behind time, but part of this is kind of getting down the process, and I think we're doing okay. Shall we move on to the next measure?
1660.
Okay. Okay, so that's Rick Chaskell.
Right?
Go ahead.
Brief description of this measure is its percentage of calendar of months within a 12-month period during which patients aged 18 years and older with a diagnosis of ESRD who are receiving hemodialysis or peritoneal dialysis have a hemoglobin level less than 10 grams per deciliter. Its numerator is the calendar months during patients having a hemoglobin level less than 10, with the last hemoglobin recorded for each calendar month, and the denominator is the calendar months during which patients aged 18 and older are receiving dialysis. A series of exclusions are listed there. It's an outcome measure. And the source is from administrative claims, electronic clinical data, health record registry, and paper. And it's a clinician group, individual, or team. And the measure is not paired, nor is it a composite.
Okay, so we'll start with, if you would just summarize what the preliminary was for impact, and we'll, Sinead, are you ready to start? So if you want to just do that first, and then we'll vote on that, and then move on to the next one.
It looks like the results were split between high and favoring high more than moderate. The importance was, again,
okay, we'll do them one at a time. So are you ready tonight? Any comments or issues about impact for this measure? Okay.
Hi, Karen. This is Lorian again. I was actually hoping to ask the primary reviewers their thought on impact. When I reviewed the measure, I thought sufficient data was presented on XY less than 10 versus less important performance measure, for example.
And I think we'll hold that for the evidence discussion related to, you know, what the perhaps the threshold to be. But this is more general about the topic area, impact on patients, we'll get to the specifics regarding, you know, I think that'll come up more under evidence.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Okay, so let's go ahead and vote on impact for this measure. This is 1660.
And Lorian? High, moderate, low, insufficient?
Moderate.
And Christine?
High.
Thank you.
Okay.
12 voted high, 9 moderate, 1 insufficient.
Okay. So let's move on to opportunity for improvement or performance gap regarding this measure. Rick?
It looks like the reviewers were split between moderate and high.
Right. And any, any particular comments about the performance gap on this that any of the reviewers or steering committee want to point out?
This is Lorian again. I'm just hoping to get clarification. What percentage of patients were less than as opposed to not between 10 and 12? I wasn't sure what was meant by
optimal before. Lorian, you're breaking up a little bit.
Sorry, Karen. Let me try that again. I was just wondering if maybe someone else on the steering committee could clarify if they were able to delineate what percentage of patients were less than 10 as opposed to not between 10 and 12. I wasn't sure what was meant by optimal care on page 4, if that was showing the percentage of patients who were, you know, falling less than 10 or what was meant by that data.
Okay. So
I think what she's asking, and I agree, the way the data is presented is 10th percentile, size 25, but it doesn't tell me what percentage of patients were below 10. Is that the 36.5%?
Okay. So we're looking at page 4 of the submission for 1660.
Right. 1B.2.
Okay. And you haven't displayed? Okay. Let's ask the measure developer.
Yeah, I'm Carrie Christensen, AMA PCPI. Just to clarify that, that's 36.51% of the patients didn't meet the measure for that year. And then the percentiles are, if you were a provider at the 10th percentile, you would have had 10.42% of your patients meet the measure.
If I can, just a comment, we're in a period of transition here where the prior assessment of this as a performance measure was looking at those who were below 10 as being bad. And now we're in a period of time where, at least as far as the FDA is concerned, below 10 maybe isn't so bad. So I think it's impossible to assess a performance gap, or we have to look at any data on a performance gap through a very different set of eyeglasses than we were before, because that's no longer considered necessarily a bad thing, whereas I think, particularly when this was done in 2008, but even a year ago or 2 years ago, the general consensus was that a hemoglobin below 10 was bad, and I'm not sure we're at that same place anymore, at least as a universal brush with which we're supposed to be facing
specific,
all of our patients.
Specific to this measure, I'm sure we'll have more discussion in the adult measures, which I understand have been withdrawn. Is there a specific... Okay, so...
Let me just clarify. This is an adult measure performance.
I misspoke. So can we broaden out this discussion somewhat in terms of the implications of this? And what are we going to do that during this evidence phase? Or?
Yes. I think we'll get to that just momentarily when we talk about the evidence, and definitely need to address that because it affects multiple measures here, and as I mentioned earlier, it's the reason that CMS withdrew their pediatric and their adult, which were facility-level measures. These measures that we're looking at now are being presented as physician performance measures.
Thank you.
So a comment was made that it's hard to interpret performance gap not knowing what the target should be or what the acceptable target.
Right. Okay, so we'll before we vote, any other comments before we vote on performance gap?
I guess the sort of takeaway for me on that is that we may not know whether high is better or low is better, or we may not know what the right thing performance is on this measure, but it actually suggests there's definitely a gap, and important to measure for that reason, because we don't know what performance is.
And I guess the confusing thing is that it says less than optimal, and if we don't know optimal, it's hard to judge these data at all. That's the problem.
But I thought it's an or statement, right? Either it's suboptimal or there's variation, right? So I just want to make sure I understand, because my understanding was if there's variation, we don't have to worry about what's optimal or not optimal. If there's variation, then that means there could be a potential performance gap, or do I have a misunderstanding?
No, you're right. The performance opportunity for improvement, I mean, the classical QI perspective is variability in performance or if there's overall suboptimal. But I think, and we will definitely address the evidence question, but I think the comments are important. I mean, one way you could address those is that, you know, maybe we don't know at this point because we don't know that what the optimal is. But anyway. But you're right in terms of what our criteria are about.
Okay, other comments? Let's vote.
All right, so this is performance gap, high, moderate, low, insufficient. Go ahead and start the...
And Lorian? High, moderate, low, insufficient?
Moderate.
And Christine?
Aye.
Thank you. Okay.
We have 6 who voted high, 8 who voted moderate, and 4 and 8 who voted insufficient. I presume because we don't know what the performance should be.
Okay.
How do we
rate that? Let's continue on with the evidence discussion, and then I think it'll become more clear what you all want to do.
Just got to say, really glad you guys started with an easy one to get us going.
All right, so Rick, you want to talk about the evidence? And we'll talk about quantity, quality, and consistency, but I think the big issue that everyone's aware of is the recent FDA announcement and how that pulls in here.
Would it be helpful just to review briefly some bullet points on the FDA?
Yes.
I have it here.
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Is it in the handout at all, is a slide, or?
Alan?
I just want to comment, it's not just the FDA.
Right.
I don't think it's just simply the FDA's announcement, but the body of data that we've come to understand in the last year.
Good point.
So should we read it so we all know it?
If you have bullet points, why don't you just briefly
The FDA drug safety communication modified dosing recommendations to improve the safe use of ESA and CKD. They made these recommendations because of data showing increased risks of cardiovascular events with ESAs in this patient population, and there was a box warning that basically said in controlled trials of CKD patients, patients experience greater risk for death, serious adverse cardiovascular reactions, and stroke when administered ESAs to target hemoglobin levels greater than 11. No trial has identified a hemoglobin target level or ESA dose or dosing strategy that does not increase these risks. And in patients with CKD, consider starting ESA treatment when the hemoglobin is less than 10 grams per cent. This advice does not recommend that the goal is to achieve a hemoglobin of 10 or greater. Individual dosing is recommended. So basically, there's nothing mentioned about the lower target here.
I actually wanted to ask a question to the measure developer, so I don't know whether this is a question or not. But I wanted to understand why, given that the facility measure has been withdrawn, if this is a physician measure, if you had some comments as to why you thought it would be important to go forward with the physician-level measure in that setting.
Thanks for the opportunity. First of all, the facility level measure was a payment measure. And when the QIP changed from no longer having the minus 10, it wasn't part of that program and therefore it was removed because it was a payment, I believe, payment method. Whereas we're talking about a physician level measure that's for public reporting. And the work group within PCPI evaluated the current situation after the FDA announcement and felt that the measure should stay in place. The reason for that is a fewfold. One is the fact that it was not saying that a certain percent of patients should be above 10. It was really looking at it as a patient safety issue. As the hemoglobin falls down, as you know, an inflection point of actually 11, the number of transfusions increase. And we saw that we would not have some way of measuring the safety effect of increasing transfusion in a vulnerable population. With the changing pattern on use of ESAs, trying to look and see whether there is going to be a normative use of this drug, having a higher and a lower measure, we felt was also important to develop future patterns. So we saw it as a safety issue. Of our patients going, how are we going to track the issue of patients getting ESAs? And as you all know, the increased incidence of sensitization and increased incidence of not getting transplants. If I could just make one other comment regarding the FDA. Remember, a year ago, a number of folks, some in this room, experts in this area, presented to the FDA advisory panel and presented some of the same data you are talking about and know today. And that expert's panel opinion was that at that time, the label should not change, that it should stay the same with the available data that was there, including after the treat and the other data. The FDA elected to ignore the advice of the advisory panel. So I think we have to keep that in mind, that the experts who testified and the advisory panel itself advised FDA not to change. And Barbara Fivish is also another person in the...
Okay, Kathleen?
Thank you. I'd really like to piggyback on that because while I really understand this is an evidence-based process, this is exactly what I'm hearing in the patient community, is that without that fail-safe, every patient I talk to is very concerned, who understands this, that their hemoglobins, the average hemoglobin is going to drop. And what that means, all the resultant complications, quality of life issues, risk of transfusion, a potential for transplant, takes a big toll on the patient. So I think everything that Dr. Jones just said is echoed multiple fold times within the patient community.
Thank you. Who else had their... Barbara?
So many of you know I'm sitting on a different side of the table now than I did last time. I would support Ed's comments and remind everybody, although, and you are going to see this as a pediatric measure, I know you've all seen this in your packets, but we have this distinction about age 18, below which you are a pediatric patient, above which you are an adult, but there are many young adults in this population that are going to fall into this measure category that are really still pediatric in our mind as pediatric nephrologists. They will need transplants. They will... if they require multiple transfusions, this is going to impact their life long term. We have data on quality of life in these young adults who are still going to school, who are still trying to get to vigorously exercise. So although we support and we understand that this is going in as an adult measure, I would just like you to consider this also as an older pediatric measure and the impact of really young adults in this measure.
I'd like to just piggyback off that and kind of mention the issue of sensitizing patients who might be getting a transplant. What this, if this turns into like it's you're looking at physician A, B, and C, and physician A has a population with a lot of patients below 10, but that might be the doctor who's trying to avoid transfusions so that his patients can get transplanted and or have a higher chance of being transplanted successfully. So, you know, what bothers me about this is the implication that it becomes a good and bad thing. You're looking at each doctor, and because I have 30% below 10, and the other doctor is 10% below 10, does that mean I'm bad compared to the physician with 10%? I don't think we can conclude that.
Well, and I guess the question is, given all the controversy around this, is it important to measure because of the controversy as opposed to overlaying a doctor who performs X or Y is bad? And I don't know the answer to that. I'm just putting it out there. It's because this is such an unknown now, is that another reason why it's important to measure without the overlay of what good or bad performance is?
I mean, Ed, I appreciate and understand everything you say and probably believe all of that in my own practice, but the issue of controversy here is whether we send this mixed message where we have an FDA and CMS trying to release one message again, but this is where things stand, and then have a variation on the theme of that. That's the concern I have about the mixed message. And theoretically, FDA and CMS made a decision based upon the best available data with a group of people impacting it. I would be curious to hear Jeff's opinion because he was before that committee you mentioned, and as far as I know, is probably the he and Alan may be the two people in this room with the most insight into this.
I wasn't at the FDA hearing. I actually spoke yesterday with somebody from the FDA who had contacted me. I think that the FDA's emphasis is switching, although it only merits one line in their black box warning and their new labeling, which is individualization of anemia management. Ideally the performance measure that we would have is the percent of physicians or patients who have appropriate hemoglobin levels for them. How we're going to accomplish that, I have no clue. I think that that I think that the treat, acquire, create, normal hematocrit data were obtained on a very specific patient population that is for which many of our patients fit, but many of our patients don't. I think we have to take the responsibility of making sure that each patient is treated appropriately, has the appropriate hemoglobin, the appropriate mix of iron and ESA therapy, avoidance of transfusion or not, depending upon the individual circumstances. And I think this is going to create, this particular measure will create huge amounts of confusion because we don't know whether this is good or bad, because it's good or bad depending upon the patient. And at the physician level, it's good or bad depending upon the mix of patients that practitioner is taking care of, whether it's a larger pediatric population, whether it's a young, healthy population, whether it's a nursing home population. And the percent, the best percent of patients below 10 may range between 0 and 100%, depending upon what type of patient population the practitioner is taking care of.
Well, it's chosen the patient to say a word. The data that we've looked at all deals with the higher hemoglobin levels and use of ESAs to achieve higher hemoglobin levels. The data doesn't address at all lower hemoglobin levels, and it's silent about hemoglobins around 11. So my own personal take on this is that we all know that hemoglobins of less than 6-7 are really bad for people. I don't think anyone would doubt that. But the data around where this measure is absent. I surely think that measurement is important. I think Lisa makes a very, very good point in an area where we're unclear. But the question before us is to endorse or not endorse a measure that talks about lower than a level for which there are just no data at all in the range of 10.
And Alan, just to follow up on that, is there anything that the developers could do to this measure that would get to what that critical gap is that we need to know? I mean, you know, if they dropped it to 7 or 8, would that be something meaningful, or would there be an above or a below threshold?
Again, I think that's the right question. I think that were we able to review data at some level where we could show the distal effects of health, that would be very useful for us, for me.
Reuben? I'm somewhat confused because we're using 10 in this measure. And that's exactly that magic number that the FDA came with. Although this measure doesn't look at ESA, but they said 10, below 10, you may be, prone to use ESAs if needed. But they brought this up. So I'm not see a big issue with what the FDA said, and this measure in particular. Now, yes, it would be measuring patients with hemoglobin of less than 10, and that's it, without saying good, bad, ugly, or the rest. But I think it does go hand in hand with what the FDA came out with. Yeah, Roberta?
Dr. Burns, I have a quick question for you. When you talk about appropriately treating the patient, what is your definition of appropriate, and does that include your feedback from the patient on how lousy they feel at hemoglobin 9 can't work and how great they feel between the 10, 11, and the 12.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the discussion I had with the gentleman from the FDA yesterday, was that I have lots of patients who I think will be inadequately treated if the results of TREAT and the other clinical trials influence rules or guidelines about how those patients should be treated. So, and this is a problem with clinical practice guidelines. It's a problem with performance measures, is that they apply to everybody. And we've had this vigorous debate on the KDIGO panel, and I'm not sure it's been entirely resolved because there's a great deal of a sort of a sense of urgency in an effort to protect patients to get away from this sort of push to increase ever increase ESA doses and iron and hemoglobin levels. But again, I think as we all recognize, the risk is that there will be patients who are ill-served by having hemoglobins of 10. Just sorting that out and then converting that to a manageable performance measure is the problem. That's the dilemma.
Andrew.
I just want to make one comment. I completely agree with Jeff. And to comment on variability in practices, if you have a practice with older patients with high cardiovascular burden and with symptomatic anemia, for example, it could be symptomatic at very different levels, and you're going to be very aggressive depending, maybe even at higher levels, as opposed to a very young population with good hearts, let's say, and much less burden, you might allow, I mean, the literature in hematology would say, you can let hemoglobin fall to fairly low levels.
Kathleen.
Thank you. I just wanted to, I did testify at that FDA hearing a year ago, and Lisa and Alan, that's exactly when they pulled the advisory committee members, that's exactly why they came to the decision they did. There was simply no studies, and that was their recommendation, was that more studies should be done. Now, the FDA going against its advisory committee when that hasn't been resolved, and what that means for our decision today, as Lisa says, I'm putting that out there.
Okay.
I'm sorry, one comment about the FDA, and maybe others can correct me if I'm wrong. Their mission is to minimize harm, not maximize benefit, I guess. And so I think we do need to keep that in mind, is that they're responding to risk of harm that was made apparent by actually a relatively small number of clinical trials, but a relatively large number of patients. Very different than thinking about individual patient potential benefit.
Jerry.
There's a tendency for a measure to be looked at anyone falling into the as into the percentage of less than 10 being high as underperforming in some way, and that has a tendency at the network level of being looked at as a problem, even though this nuance of how it should be interpreted may be understood at this committee, but not so much at the network. So the point being that this is a theoretical, but if the number of 10 is chosen and you're in that category of having a high percentage of people under 10, you're going to tend to push the ESAs so that you don't let your overall population fall down to a certain percentage under 10. And it's very difficult, as we all know, to tightly regulate ESAs. I think it's just going to shift the curve back up to a higher percentage of people being over 11 if we're trying to avoid being under 10. I'm conflicted on this because I still think, for all the reasons that Dr. Jones mentioned and others, that this is a valid measure, but it does have the unintended consequence of pushing the average hemoglobins within a clinic up so that you're going to have a certain percentage that will then shoot over the top and get too high.
Right, and in that way, it could be unintended harm. In other words, it's going to encourage treating more patients with ESA than you would if you're being evaluated on that criteria. We have the developer wanting to make a comment. Anybody else before we go there? Okay, Deidre.
Hi, Deidre Joseph with the AMA PCPI. We just wanted to point out that there are several denominator exclusions for the measure. We have documentation of medical reasons for a patient having a hemoglobin level less than 10 grams per deciliter. And we've listed examples here, including patients who have non-renal etiologies of anemia, including sickle cell anemia or other hemoglobinopathies, multiple myeloma, primary bone marrow disease, anemia related to chemotherapy for diagnosis of malignancy, and other medical reasons.
Okay. So, Jaren, how do we proceed?
All right. So I guess what we will do is vote on the quantity, quality, and consistency of the body of evidence, and then we'll see where we're at. Alan, did you have a question? Or okay. All right.
Just a clarification on this item, it's the quantity of studies addressing this specific hemoglobin level, not whether or not anemia is a good thing or a bad thing.
Right.
Hi, this is Christine. I wanted to make a comment on the body of evidence because we've heard a lot of discussions both for and against the actual hemoglobin target, but one of the things that I was trying to do as I was reviewing this particular measure is look at the evidence that they were presenting specific to the consequences of a hemoglobin level less than 10 as opposed to being within a goal range. And I think the body of evidence that they're presenting is pointing to having a hemoglobin target within a particular range.
Okay.
So let's vote on quantity, and the options are high, moderate, low, insufficient.
And Lorian, quantity?
Insufficient.
And Christine?
Insufficient.
Okay, one high, two moderate, four low, 15 insufficient.
Okay. So let's move on to the next one, which is quality of the body of evidence. Again, the options are high, moderate, low, insufficient, and go ahead, Janae.
And Lorian, quality?
Insufficient.
And Christine?
Insufficient.
That's enough to kill it off right there.
We'll go ahead and finish it up, though.
Andrew, are you voting now?
One more vote. Okay. Everybody has voted.
I guess that's all the votes we're going to get. Okay. Okay. Three votes for moderate, three for low, 15 for insufficient.
Okay. And then finally, consistency of the body of evidence. And again, the options are high, moderate, low, insufficient. And go ahead and start the timer.
And Lorian, consistency?
Insufficient.
And Christine?
Insufficient.
Thank you.
Is everyone voting? Anybody not voting? We're missing one for some reason.
Okay.
Coming to the restroom. Okay. Let's go ahead. Results are 2 moderate, 1 low, and 17 insufficient.
Okay. So let's just sum up. It obviously did not pass evidence. And where were we on opportunity for improvement? 1B. Okay. So basically, this measure would not pass the importance to measure and report criterion. Any further comments on that? Okay. So let's go on to
Alan.
Is there a way for us, though, to register? I want to go back to Lisa's comment before, because it doesn't pass, but if we take a consensus here of the importance to be measuring hemoglobin levels in our dialysis patients, I think you'd have 100% agreement to that. So this specific measure doesn't make it, but it would be important somehow for us to register our concern that hemoglobin is an important measurable intermediate outcome in our patients.
So this gets to then having a performance measure on just whether it's being assessed. Is that what you're suggesting? And this may be a good example of when that's needed based on the fact that the evidence doesn't support a specific target. I guess the question would be, is there anything else that could be measured that's more proximal to the desired outcome? Is there any treatment approach? And I know that that's individualized as well, so I just wanted to lay that out there to see if there was evidence that would support a performance measure that was more proximal to the outcome.
I don't think so. I think that's about as close as we can come to the outcome. The outcome is excellent anemia management for each individual patient. And because it varies so much, maybe the closest we can get is that at least the hemoglobin level, iron levels are being looked at. Okay.
All right, let's.
According to my agenda, lunch is supposed to be ready at 12:30, so we could actually, although we need to have a little time for comment, but should we go on to the next?
Well, I wonder, so the next 2 measures are in the, let's see, we have 1666. Which is about greater than 12. Should we maybe talk about 1667 is the same measure but the pediatric version, less than 10. So let me just ask, and maybe we'll just do a, do people feel like you would vote the same way on the pediatric measure that you just voted on the
We need to, I mean, there's specific pediatric data that I think needs to be discussed.
Okay.
And, you know, what has been discussed isn't germane to that.
Okay. All right. Then we won't go there. we'll continue through the measures then. Maybe we can, do you want to try to do 1667 or do you want to do...
I think we should try to do one more before. Why don't you at least get started on that?
All right. So. Well, then let's go ahead. According to schedule 1666, there's a question.
Just as a rule, we don't call on the developers unless we have a question for you. Right. So you can't just raise your hand and expect to be called. You can raise your hand, and we might, but we might not. So I don't think we have any questions for you right now.
Right. And when we have public comment, if you haven't had a chance, you can do it during the comment period as well.
We just had a question about the format, kind of the benefits versus harms discussion. We didn't know if that would apply to every measure or not.
No, only under certain conditions that are outlined in the evidence table.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to go to 1667.
We'll go ahead in order. 1666.
Right. Well, that's... Oh, 1666. Sorry.
Okay. So that's Ruben?
now that we answer all the questions we need to answer, this should be easy. It should be very easy. 1666 is really patients on ESA with a hemoglobin level of over 12. Essentially, it's a percentage calendar month on a year, 12 months. And hemoglobin is measured, this is an adult, so patients over 18 years old with the diagnosis of CKD and ESRD. So CKD stage 4 and 5 and ESRD, both on hemo and peritoneal dialysis, who are also receiving ESAs and had a hemoglobin of over 12. Now, they asked that this hemoglobin is the last hemoglobin done in that month. Again, this is a calendar month. The numerator, as we said, people with hemoglobin over 12, with the denominator being people on ESAs, adults over 18 years old, with CKD 4, 5, and ESRD. It's an outcome measure, and we could go directly to the impact, if that's okay. On the impact, we have four of the work group. We have three highs and two moderate. Any comments, anything from the work group members?
Anyone else want to make any comments? Otherwise, we can go to vote. All right, so we're voting on impact for measure 1666 as described, and options high, moderate, low, insufficient. And go ahead, Sinead, start the timer.
And Lorian, impact? Lorian, are you still there?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Hi.
And Christine, impact?
Hi.
Good 22, okay. Results are 16 votes for high, 5 moderate, 1 low.
Must mean that we're hungry. Okay. On the opportunity of improvement, again, the members, we had one I, three, two M's, moderate, and one high.
Could you remind us of the performance gap?
I was the insufficient evidence. I just had a question of clarification. In the data that was presented, they're talking about 63.5% of patients did not receive optimal care. And I'm just double-checking to make sure. Does optimal care mean the measure specifications itself?
That's a good question. For measure developer, that does mean we're getting a pause. That means, let me just rephrase it then, 63.5% of patients in a calendar year had hemoglobin greater than 12.
On
each one time?
On ESA.
It's the 63.5% of patients did not meet the measure.
Did not have a hemoglobin greater than 12. So then 37% of patients during the calendar year had one or more hemoglobins 12 or greater than 12?
There's a lot of negatives there, isn't there?
Well, we need to know what this will help us judge if there's a performance gap or not.
A patient meeting the measure would be a patient who has a hemoglobin level greater than 12. A patient not meeting the measure, which would be 63.5% of patients, did not have a hemoglobin level greater than 12.
Patient months. You're defining optimal care as having a hemoglobin.
Optimal care is meeting the measure.
But optimal care is actually not meeting the measure. That's the problem, one problem with the way this is written.
Yeah. It's poor wording.
Yeah, we would view it as a safety measure, and if you're high, that's negative. So anyway, 37.5% of patients, therefore, did not have a hemoglobin greater than 12. Is it once or more?
I think I heard that the other way around.
That's 63% were good. Right. But again, the measure is months.
Okay.
Does this data refer to months, and does this data refer to CKD 4 and 5 not on dialysis?
This measure is a combination of two measures because it uses CKD 4, 5, and ESRD. In the past, we had just an ESRD measure. So this one combines both groups.
The measure does, but I'm not sure their performance gap data includes non-dialysis patients.
Correct. You're completely correct. So if we may summarize again, can we summarize again what really that 63.5% that did not receive optimal care means?
Yes. Cross out did not receive optimal care and put in the word 63.5% of patients did not meet the measure. So 63.5% of patients did not have hemoglobin level greater than or equal to 12.
So 37% above is still a significant amount, although we all know that in the variability of actual clinical practice, patients' hemoglobins wander around a lot, and a lot of patients will just get over 12 once or twice during the year. So, again, we're you wanted to use the word optimal care. In other words, is it really bad if somebody exceeds this measure? Is that something that is implied by passing?
The question here is precisely whether this performance gap is measured.
I hear you. Yeah. Okay. So let's vote.
Okay. All right. So let's go ahead. Ready to vote. Performance gap on this measure, high, moderate, low, insufficient. Go ahead. Start.
And Lorian? Performance
moderate.
Gap? I'm sorry, moderate?
Yes.
And Christine?
High.
Okay, the results are 7 high, 12 moderate, 3 insufficient. So then we can go on to this is not
this is an outcome.
This is a health outcome. Yeah.
Well, this is actually an intermediate clinical outcome, so we will skip this question.
Okay.
And let's talk about the evidence.
Now in the evidence, it's clear that the owners of the measure did mention there's, like we have said in many other words, there's lack of information to support a specific hemoglobin cutoff value. It renders this, a lot of this evidence, like we have discussed, comes from clinical practice guidelines and some of the RCTs that they mentioned from the in the information that was given. So we can be talking about this for a while, so I'll open for comments.
I guess one concern that I had in recent FDA CMS releases was that there may be harm when the hemoglobin is high with ESAs, particularly at high dose. The question is the threshold for that high, whether it's 11, 12, or 13. more recently, 11 and higher is being brought into question, and we've opted to use the 12 number. So that threshold would be the specific concern I had with using that number.
I guess my comment is that I think we need to consider this as a safety measure. We know that targeting hemoglobins in the high range, 13, and achieving levels in the 12 somewhere, has a higher incidence of harm than we mostly would be comfortable with. So my interpretation is that this is a measure that is monitoring a safety signal. And we don't have an achieved hemoglobin level, that evidence for a level of achieved hemoglobin that will give us an adequate cutoff. So I think Joe's comments are well taken. I just would point out that there's a difference between complete absence of evidence at the low end, which is what we talked about before, and a safety signal at the high end, and the committee needs to consider that as we make our decisions.
I think the other comment to make, again, although I'm not sure how this is going to translate in practice, this is percentage of calendar months that a patient has a hemoglobin above 12. So if a patient has a hemoglobin above 12 in one calendar month, then that would only count as whatever that is, 9% or 8% for them. So it's maybe a better way of looking at some of these things than just saying the percent of patients who are above 12, because that's not really an important number.
I'd like to hear a little bit more about what you're saying, or maybe I couldn't hear you very well, but you're saying this is not just a percentage of patients, but it's a percentage of time in a year that a given patient...
Yes, if I interpret this correctly, it's the percentage of calendar months during which a patient has a hemoglobin above 12, so that if a patient has, I guess looking at the way we used to do this is the percentage of patients who have a hemoglobin above 12, you just add them all up. And if they have a hemoglobin above 12 one month out of the entire year, during that month they get counted the same way as a patient who has a hemoglobin above 12 for 8 months out of the year. This way, in this measure, if I understand it correctly, it sort of scales that so that the patient who is above 12 for 6 months a year is recorded differently than a patient who has a hemoglobin above 12 just 1 month out of the year. And maybe the measure developer can correct me if I'm wrong, but that's how I interpret this measure.
This is intended to be a physician-level metric?
Yes.
So doesn't it still come out the same in a sense that if you have 12 patients and one patient is 10% and one is 20 and one is 40 and one is 60, you can do a numeric average of those percentages, and it's going to tell you sort of the average number of months during the year that your patients were out of compliance or, you know, were above that. No? Okay, let's ask the developer to illuminate.
I think your interpretation, Jeff, is it's the number of months. I cannot answer if you average, add them up and average you come out with the total percentage of patients.
Can I, just from Elena's perspective, it would seem to me that then you're getting at the chronically high, the folks who are an ongoing problem all the time, as opposed to somebody who may stray over the line once. Now, that may just be my intuitive sense of this, but that's what it seems like to me.
So a target could be set, for example, at 10% is okay, which would be 1 month a year, but 50% is not good. Is that the way it's intended to be used as a safety measure?
I think a value, I mean, the way I interpret this again, and this gets to the issue that I raised the last time we met about having, you know, a measure related to, say, consecutive months above 12 rather than a month above 12, is exactly what you said. This it sort of allows forgiveness for your first speeding ticket, but if you get three in a row, you know, you have to pay some, you've got points. And that's, I think, that's how this would translate into practice.
So now I'm a little confused. Let's say you have the 12 patients, and two are greater than 12 every month, and the rest of them are fine. And as your stable of patients, you get an answer that seems fine.
I'm concerned
that you could potentially miss that signal for the patients we're trying to protect, which are those always over 12. So the question is that measure protecting those patients?
Yes, sir. I'm not sure that this does everything that you'd want it to do, but again, I think as you add it up, the way I would think of this again is if you have a patient, one patient who's above 12 for the whole year is one time, is 100% times one patient. A patient who's, who's half the year would be 50% times one patient, and then you add up all those and you come up with a percentage. There's going to be a lot missing there, as you say, because it will be an average over all of those patients, but it probably would give a signal. The higher this number, obviously, the more patients you have who are spending lots of time above 12. Again, the same, you could get at the same information by saying the percentage of patients who have hemoglobins above 12 for 3 consecutive months or 6 consecutive months or what have you.
Just, again, just real quickly, it's the reason that we advocated last time for calling a safety signal or a failure people with consistently high calciums or consistently high hemoglobins. I think that, Joe, would be a better way for us to do it, but we don't have that before us. And with the measure that is before us, I share Jeff's sentiment.
Okay, are we ready to vote on the body of evidence?
Okay, so let's vote on quantity of evidence, high, moderate, low, insufficient. Start the timer.
And Lorian, quantity?
Moderate.
And Christine?
Moderate.
Oh, someone's out? Okay.
Okay.
Go ahead. So we have 4 high and 17 moderate. Okay. The next slide is the quality.
Yeah. All right.
Lorian, quality?
Moderate.
Christine?
Moderate.
Waiting for one more, you might revote if you. Maybe somebody didn't. Someone's abstaining. Okay, we can go. Go ahead. All right, 1 high, 18 moderate, 1 low. And finally, the consistency. Go ahead to the next one, please. Consistency of results across the body of evidence, high, moderate, low, insufficient. Go ahead.
Lorian, consistency? Lorian?
Moderate.
Christine?
Moderate.
Okay, I think we're only going to get 20.
Go ahead
and stop it. 2 high, 16 moderate, and 2 low. So this would pass the quality of evidence.
Right, okay. So basically, where are we at, Lauren, with impact with fine, moderate, opportunity for improvement, and now evidence, so we can move on and talk about reliability and validity.
Okay. Ruben?
On the reliability, again, we talked already about the numerator and denominator, but we're talking again about calendar months and on both ends, on the numerator and denominator. And and they talk about consecutive months, which is the other thing. I don't think that they don't have any risk adjustments on this measure, so there's no risk adjustment, and I really don't have any other comment at this time, so I'll open it for comments on.
Okay, and we'll specifically talk about reliability and validity separately, so right now reliability and risk adjustment, we can address whether that's an issue under mm-hmm. validity. On the reliability testing, did you think it looks like the reviewers thought that it met the moderate category, so were there any questions about reliability? Is that any questions?
So again, since this is a measure that spans CKD 4, 5, not on dialysis as well as on dialysis, I think we need to be very clear where this has been tested, because I suspect it's not been tested at all in the CKD not on dialysis or in enough venues to get any sense that this can be reliably collected and analyzed in different practice settings.
So I wanted to ask the developer where this was tested. You can give us some information about the testing.
Sure. I don't know if maybe you guys can bring it up on the screen, the scientific acceptability section of the form. On mine, it's page 27 of 43, but I don't have your copy. So it kind of goes through the data sample. This was tested in 4 nephrology practice sites that represented a variety of types, locations, and sizes to get a good cross-section of the environment. Number of physicians per site ranged from 5 to 62 physicians in 4 different regions of the United States. Patient volume ranged from 240 to 2,800 ESRD patients seen per month. The sample size per physician organization ranged from 24 to 30 patients for patients on peritoneal dialysis or hemodialysis. And we use the analytic method of both percent agreement and the Kappa statistic, which adjusts for chance agreement. And this measure came out as highly reliable with a Kappa of 0.9860 and 99.45% agreement.
These are all dialysis patients.
Do I need CKD data? Are there any?
Tested at all in non-dialysis. This is not tested in non-dialysis.
It was, but we presented the ESRD data because that was the primary population.
Well, except there's actually many more patients with CKD 4
yeah,
and 5
I can,
in this country than there are on dialysis.
Hang on 1 second. So.
And could somebody also maybe speak to the wisdom of having these as one measure with the two populations as opposed to two separate measures?
I'll just mention from one standpoint, if it's the same target or the same numerator, there are some advantages to having one measure. You're always sure that they're going to be harmonized. It captures the intended population. If you think there's a reason that it should be stratified, that can be discussed. I mean, there are pros and cons to it, but those are some of the reasons.
Then, of course, my key question would be is how exactly is CKD 3 and 4, especially 3, defined?
This is just 4 and 5.
I'm sorry. Even 4 is defined. Is it estimated, is it based on the creatinine? Is it
measured clearance? Is what's provided in the specification.
Right. So that would be in the denominator specifications, which would be... let's see, for the denominator, let me find it.
And I don't know if this is a good time to talk about the e-specification, but I don't know if others also had concerns about some of the data elements listed in the patient population, including things like procedure codes for continuous venous hemodiafiltration, which I think would mostly be acute kidney injury. And then under the different hemoglobins being pulled under laboratory tests, there were numerous hemoglobins, including hemoglobin F1, hemoglobin S, Gulf hemoglobin. There were just numerous lab measures that weren't actually relevant to this measure. And I didn't know what the, other steering committee members thought about the e-specification.
Go ahead. You can respond.
Sorry. Yeah, I'm not responding to that, but to the point, the question that I needed to look up for the CKD patient, the kappa was 0.9867, which, again, is highly reliable, and the reliability was 99.4%.
So let me clarify and ask you this. It doesn't say this specifically, but did you have raters go in and look at the same data? In other words, rater one would look at patient A data, and then another rater would come and look at, that's what you're talking about, inter-rater reliability. Okay, that's good. That's what I consider to be reliability testing.
So the question then was less than 50
people. Can I clarify, was the reliability testing done based on chart review at the facilities or how you're proposing to implement the measure using CPT codes and EHR data?
Well, that's not implementing. That's just a way.
No, it's specified for CPT2 codes.
Because the numerator details are going to be a CPT2 code, correct?
I guess
when I read the reliability testing, I thought you were actually maybe going into the clinics and abstracting data straight from the charts as opposed to looking at CPT2 codes. So I was just hoping to get clarification on that.
Excellent question. So the measures is available for use in a variety of data sources, including using CPT2 codes, but also for EHR and for chart review. So the inter-rater reliability we did do with two human beings doing manual abstraction from either an EHR or a paper record. We did compare to PQRI implementation, which is what I believe you're speaking of with the CPT2 codes, where that was possible. It's on page... Sorry, there's a lot of data here. I can tell you it's about 60% for this measure. There was trouble with the CPT2 coding. This was one of the first years that PQRI was implemented, and because it was a monthly measure, the way the facilities do their billing, which I'm sure is not news to you guys, is on a monthly basis. They have one charge for the month of care, and a lot of times they were using the lab data from, for example, May if it was the June bill. So that didn't match up with the way that the abstractors did that in calendar months. Take what you want to out of that number.
So the testing was done on medical record chart abstraction, but you're not really intending to have the measured that way, right, going and doing chart abstraction.
I believe we submitted this for manual paper chart review for EHR specifications and for claims.
And, Lorian, you had concerns about the EHR specifications. Is that what you were saying earlier?
Right, just about trying to clarify some of the data elements. It was unclear to me some of the procedure codes being included, continuous hemodiafiltration, and also all of the hemoglobins that were many are, things like hemoglobin F, which is fetal hemoglobin, and relevant and other hemoglobin variants. And I know the exclusion criteria has sickle cell disease and other things, but it was unclear to me why so many different types of hemoglobins that aren't relevant to the measure are being included in the ESA.
Do you have a response?
We do not have a specifications person here. I am not sure if there's one available on the phone or not.
So if I'm understanding this right, if the data is coming from different sources, do we require that they check validity of every single possible way of getting data? You know, chart abstraction is one, and they've shown that if you take the chart and you go over and put the data in the system, it seems to be pretty reliable. But there's other methods of collecting data, and you haven't checked the validity of every method separately.
We did compare the PQRI data to the manual abstraction, but like I said, the results are probably lower than they would be if that was tested again today.
Well, I would say this, that compared to a lot of the reliability testing we get on these forms, I give you great credit for having done it and actually reported it, and I think that So
Peter, let me just, the rejoinder to that, and I agree, is that that was only for a segment of the population where being asked about reliability testing. It's only tested in ESRD patients, not in stage 4 or stage 5 CKD patients. We have no data for that.
I actually read that. I'm sorry. I can read that again for you. It's it was maybe a 0.01 off of it. Let me find it again. The CKD data was for the reliability percentage, the percentage agreement, 99.4, and the kappa was 0.9867.
So how did you what population did you test CKD, not on dialysis? How did you do that testing? How did you find those patients? How did you test this in non-dialysis patients?
Describe how you found the patients and how you did the study.
So there's denominator specifications for the measure, and the denominator specifications are found using the clinic systems to meet the specific codes or conditions that they're supposed to be on.
Okay, so in the physician practices, based on the CPT coding, you found stage 4 and stage 5 CKD patients, and in that population you tested the validity,
yes,
or the reliability. Thank you.
Yes, and I apologize for not including both of them.
And this is Lori, and again, I apologize for asking this. Again, I just want to make sure I understand correctly. When the measure is actually implemented, there will be a component of chart review, or it will rely only on CPT-2 codes?
Yes,
it would depend on how the program or the institution decided to implement the measure. So they could implement it using claims, they could implement it using EHRs, or if they had no other way to do it and still wanted to do quality improvement in this area, they could do manual chart review. Obviously, that's the least efficient method.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so let's vote on 2A reliability, including precise specifications and the reliability testing. High, moderate, low, or insufficient.
Okay. And Lorian?
Low.
Low. And Christine?
High.
Steve's not back. Is anybody else missing? No, we're not getting to 21. Oh, we got there. Okay. All right. We have 4 high, 9 voting moderate, 5 low, and 3 insufficient. I think moderate carries the day.
Okay. So validity.
Okay, on to validity. Ruben, did you have – Ruben, can you comment on the validity?
Still trying to find the hemoglobin that we're, you know, we're disclosed here. But I'm sorry. Go ahead. The question on
– we're up to validity.
Validity.
Now, how did you rate it?
Let me go back to the – on the validity, at least on the report, and I'm sorry, I'm looking at my computer here.
Well, looks like the preliminary viewers, three rated it moderate. We had three.
Thank you, because that's what I was looking at.
And the validity. I'm sorry, Ruben.
No, go ahead.
And maybe you want to mention what type of validity. Yeah. Is it faith validity or some other type of validity that they...
The panel or this expert panel was used to do the access to face validity of the measure, and there were 21 members. You can see them on your list. And according to the expert panel, seven of them were either strong or very strong, 10 of them, on the testing results from internal validity. Now,
That's fine. So they did face validity of the major score.
So the question asked to the panel was, the scores obtained from the measure as specified will accurately differentiate quality across providers. And only the 17 out of 19 either voted 4 or 5, which is 10 to agree or strongly agree. That was their validity testing. Because they did reliability of their data elements,
We don't necessarily combine them.
If they hadn't done, or if they'd claimed it was electronic, then we would like to see validity testing of the elements. And in a sense, though, what they did is that also validity testing of the elements, or just reliability?
Primarily reliability in your extractor. But according to our criteria, base validity would meet the moderate rating. If you agreed with their assessment, if you had questions about it, then we'd have to talk about it.
A question. I don't see, and this was raised before, a definition of, or how CKD 4 and 5 is determined. So one issue that we should think about in terms of, I think it's validity, although it might be reliability, is whether you use MBRD formula, which is what most commercial labs use, or whether you use CKD Epi, which labs may be using. I'm sorry. The question I'm asking is if you, it's not specified in the denominator, how CKD 4 and 5 stages not on dialysis are identified. And that patient population will be different depending upon the formula that's used, MDRD versus CKD Epi. It will also vary probably from on the edges from month to month. So is a single estimated GFR that puts you in stage 4 right on the borderline of 3 sufficient to flip you into this measure, and then the next month you might flip out of the measure potentially? So those are just some uncertainties I have about the denominator that may impact validity.
Exactly. So, and that's a valid point to bring up. So even though they did this, which is, you know, according to our criteria, minimal on face validity, if there are concerns about the validity of the data to accurately capture the right patients, that's an issue for your discussion. Before we vote on validity, you also need to address whether the exclusions in any way impact validity, and also since this is a intermediate clinical outcome, whether there are any considerations that need to be reviewed regarding risk adjustment, or why not. So all of that kind of factors into this ultimately your vote on validity.
And I'm maybe somewhat confused, but you know, going back and forth through this, I don't see any exclusions in this.
There are none.
Right, but did they identify some exceptions? Let me just look. Looks like none, right?
There's no risk adjustment either.
All right.
and no exceptions.
Right. Okay.
I believe I can answer the question about the categorization by stage. It was done by ICD-9 codes by the individual practice, but we don't know which formula that practice used to determine what stage that patient was in.
And, Lorian, you were mentioning in looking at the EHR specifications, you had questions about the, was it about the CKD codes or something else? I don't remember what you said.
When I was looking at the EHR specifications, it does appear that all the CKD is based on ICD-9 coding. But to identify dialysis patients, they also use a number of procedure codes. And some of the procedure codes, like continuous veno-veno hemodiafiltration, which is a modality we use in injury classically, not chronic dialysis. So there were some procedure codes that surprised me. And I didn't know how others felt about how the population was actually being identified, similar to, the inclusion of all of these lab tests that didn't really seem relevant to the measure. So the procedure codes are on page 2 of the e-specification. And at least my understanding is this is how the initial population is identified, the ICT.
And just,
And again, maybe these patients will fall out, but it's unclear to me why they're even being considered for inclusion in the ICT.
Again, I don't find that data here, so I'm not sure we're talking about the same measure, but...
It's the coding spreadsheet for PCPIE specification, AKID-7, patients on erythropoiesis-stimulating agent, hemoglobin level greater than 12. It was the appendix, correct, Karen? These were all appendix materials?
Yes. In the folder with the measure submission form, there was an appendix, a PDF file. Lauren's got it up now. And what page do you want us to take a look at, Lorian?
So, the initial pages are just kind of their outline of the flow sheets, but if you get to the actual, it looks like an Excel spreadsheet where they start listing how the ICP is selected, what the numerator and denominator include. So that's page 1 of that Excel spreadsheet, coding spreadsheet for PCPIE specification.
We're looking at that now.
Okay. And that's where you can see that, it looks like all codes are being used for CKD stage 4 and 5 identification. But as you scroll to page 2, at least my understanding is there are some procedure codes being used to identify dialysis patients. But some of these procedure codes include things like continuous veno-veno hemodiafiltration and extracorporeal albumin hemodialysis and things that just are... I don't think relevant to chronic outpatient hemodialysis. And then these are the same pages that include all of those different hemoglobin measures I mentioned that would appear to show up in the denominator, and that's further down on page 5. So my concern is why are some of these being included in the e-specification?
So you're arguing it may not be as valid as we think because there's patients who are getting acute dialysis procedures or other types of procedures.
That we're not really interested in.
That we're not interested in, and in fact, I suppose, stop.
They'll probably all have low hemoglobin, so again, you could argue the relevance, but... again, this is one of my concerns under reliability when we were talking about specification of the data elements, especially as you get to all the hemoglobins listed on page 5, to include things like hemoglobin F1 and hemoglobin G and sulfhemoglobin.
Okay.
I mean, these just are not laboratory measures that are relevant to the proposed measure.
Michael?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think this is a big concern for the validity of defining the denominator. We've actually tried to look at this with VA data. We did a study with ESRD, and we could not really come up with any algorithm of CPT codes for dialysis that would sort out chronic dialysis from acute dialysis. And then there's these continuous codes, which obviously aren't germane to a chronic population, but using CPT codes to identify chronic dialysis, at least our experience had been, was very problematic. And in the end, we had to use, you know, USRDS data to definitely define someone as having ESRD. But I don't know if the, maybe I didn't review this directly. It wasn't assigned to me. I don't know if the people who created this measure, the measure developers, have a response or if they had a particular reason why this is their approach.
Well, let's ask.
Maybe shooting in the dark. I mean, I'm not a specification expert here, but I think if you look at this tape, if you go to page where it says PCP E specification, it lists the CPT codes that were used. If you go to the table, all of those CPT codes are things that we would equate with ESRD. On that whole table are other things that was previously mentioned. The CBVH code, but those were not listed as a CPT code. They're in that table, but they weren't the ones that were used when the patient was categorized.
Then there's a mismatch between, so I guess part of the issue is then.
Well, I think, are we talking about the CPT2 codes or the procedure codes? The CPT2 code to identify the numerator versus these procedural codes being used to identify processes. I'm not sure I may not understand the distinction. I was thinking the CPT2 code is going to potentially be used by some practices to identify the numerator, but then these are going to be used, these procedure codes, to try and, I think these are procedure codes, but, you know, others I think have more expertise in these as to, you know, how you identify continuous veno-veno hemodialysis filtration. I thought this was going to be used to identify the ITP. But I am not an expert in this either, so I would definitely appreciate others' thoughts on how they interpret these tables and then what's included in the test.
So you want to clarify what the intention of this table was. We think it's your specifications for an electronic health record mm-hmm. measure, but it doesn't seem to match what your English language denominator mm-hmm. is.
No, right. It's it is meant to be the EHR specifications, and like we said, we don't have a specification staff person here, but I just got word that she is on the phone, but she cannot be heard. So she told me to say, we appreciate the feedback and would be happy and willing to revise. I think it's the issue that the gentleman over here talked about. It is difficult to differentiate between the ESRD categories, but we are more than willing to revise if there are some incorrect codes in there.
So I think one of the things we can do to move forward is we could perhaps divorce the EHR measure specifications from this measure at this point, and then if they can bring in EHR specifications that would really be and show a crosswalk to the actual measure, then we can consider that being part of the endorsement. Would that work for people if at this point we focus on the measure with the CPT2 codes, are the medical record abstraction process, divorce the EHR specifications at this point, move forward, and then we can talk with the developer about whether it's possible to get EHR specifications in our time frame. Okay?
Yep.
Any objections to that approach?
And the committee understands that there's no perfect method of identifying dialysis patients, and you know, we hope it will be as good as it can be, but perfection isn't the goal.
Right.
Isn't the requirement.
Right. Can I ask one other question of the developer, and that is the accuracy of the CPT, I don't know whether it's a CPT or ICD-9 designation for CKD 4 and 5, whether that was done accurately. You know, in other words, did you go back and confirm that if the chart said CKD 4, that it in fact was CKD 4?
Yes.
All right, so we could.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Janet.
Can you just clarify? I think you said a few minutes ago that for the purposes of the evaluation, the validity in this piece, that face validity was considered evidence of moderate.
It will meet your moderate, right?
Okay, that's what I. Okay, because that's different than what I teach. So I just wanted
to.
But one last thing before we vote on validity is any discussion about the fact that there's no risk adjustment, and the question is whether there's any analysis. Do you expect this intermediate clinical outcome to vary based on patient characteristics? And, you know, hemoglobin level, and is there any reason to think that it would be significant enough to warrant some analysis? They didn't provide any analysis, so it's just a question to the steering committee whether that there's any question or issue that you want to bring up before we move forward. Okay. Well, then let's go ahead and vote on validity. High, moderate, low, insufficient.
And Lorian? Validity?
Moderate.
Moderate. Christine?
Moderate.
Thank you.
That should be at 21, right?
Okay.
Moderate 15, low 4, insufficient 2.
Okay, so why don't we just move on and finish this one out rather than breaking. So it would pass scientific acceptability, so let's go on to usability. I'm sorry, disparities. We need to do a rating of high, moderate, low, or insufficient.
No, if disparities were identical.
Right. Okay. All right, great.
That, and again, just for future, it would be nice to have an NA when you vote on this in the thingamajigger.
Okay, good. Yes. Thank you.
Okay.
Usability. Any, Ruben?
No, I don't have any issues. I mean, they report here the usability in the sense of it's been used for the PQRI and PQRS in the past. Again, I think we have to be careful because some of this, as was stated, was dialysis more than CKD. It was, according to their note, it's been used in the, also used in the 2009 and 2010 CMS PQRI programs. I think the if I'm reading this correctly, there you are, two moderates and yeah.
And just to clarify, it's being used in those programs, but currently there's no performance data on physicians publicly available. So it's being reported, but there's no access to performance data. All right.
We did present the 2008 data. That's noted in here that it's confidential, but we were able to provide that to you. So that's where the Gavin Share data came from.
Okay. Ready? Any discussion about usability? And this is both for public reporting and quality improvement, and high, moderate, low, insufficient tonight.
Lorian, usability?
Moderate.
And Christine?
Moderate.
This is for public reporting.
Usability for both public reporting and quality improvement. Okay. How many should we have this? Oh, I think there's two people out.
Okay.
Okay. All right.
So for usability, 2 high, 13 moderate, 3 low, 2 insufficient.
Okay.
That passes.
So we'll go on to feasibility. And Ruben, anything to report?
Not much. You can see that on the multiple questions, most of the information is generated from provision of care, mostly electronic health records, and they're not aware of any unintended consequence at this point. And the committee voted anywhere between high to moderate on most of the questions.
Okay. Any discussion about feasibility?
Just to, I hate to beat a dead horse here, but just to clarify, it, feasibility can be looked at as once you have identified the patient and you have their lab data, can you create the numerator and denominator? That seems to be what they're addressing here, as opposed to feasibility is sort of taking a step back and making sure you've identified the right patients and in a practice and identified the physician responsible. So there's several steps that are that need to occur prior to identifying a CKD patient or knowing that this is a CKD patient and having a hemoglobin level matched up to them. And I'd like to just have clarity that that was what was addressed and that it is feasible across a variety of different practice settings, electronic health records, there's Epic, there's Sunrise, there's paper, and all of those would need to be perused for this data. I'm not sure we have information on the feasibility of that.
Right. So it's a good question. We would really expect to address most of what you mentioned under validity. Can you capture the data accurately? Can you have a valid measurement? Under feasibility, the focus is more on burden of measurement, whether, you know, there are systems to capture the data. So, and the way we tend to think of this is that, because it's exactly what people would bring up before, is that, well, it's usable if it's reliable and valid, or it's feasible if it's reliable and valid, and we try to make distinctions there. But, so I understand that there's, you know, those things kind of carry over into the following criteria, but it really is more about that it can be captured and the burden of collection. So,
I guess my question is, I'm not seeing any evidence of feasibility.
Operator, are you on the line?
Hi, I'm here.
I can no longer hear the conference call.
The line is open. I'm not sure if it is.
I'm sorry. I didn't have my microphone on. So, Jeff, do you have a specific question, or are you just making a note that we really don't have any information about feasibility?
Well, I guess I'm asking if there's any data and then making the comment that I don't see any and that not every practice in the United States has an electronic health record.
Right. And basically the way it was tested was, and so far the way it's been implemented, have not involved electronic health records. It's involved either CPT-2 codes off of claims or medical record abstraction. So CPT-2 codes off of claims would also be an electronic source, but it's not an electronic health record exactly. So does TCPI have anything additional to say about
this? Yeah, I'm not sure if this is answering your question, so please ask follow-up ones if it doesn't. The way we did our testing was that we had the practice generate a list of patients they believed were eligible for the measures, and then the manual reviewers confirmed the denominator, the numerator, and exceptions if there were exceptions for the measure, independently of whether or not the other reviewer felt that way or the original list, they independently confirmed that. And then secondly, we did provide data with the number of physicians that were using this in the PQRI program for 2009, which is, of course, PQRS now. The numbers have been going up year by year for implementation.
Did that answer your concerns, Jeffrey?
Okay. So let's go ahead and vote on feasibility. High, moderate, low, insufficient.
And Lorian, feasibility? Lorian?
Low.
Christine?
High.
Okay, that should be it. Yeah. 1, high, 10, moderate, 8, low, 2, insufficient.
So let's move on to the last question for this measure, which is now overall, do you feel that the measure meets the criteria to be suitable for endorsement? And again, this would be preliminary, and we would have to look at if there are any harmonization or competing measures issues. But if there weren't, then that if a yes vote would mean it would be recommended.
And also that they will provide more data on the validity questions that were outstanding.
Well, what we've talked about right now, we would be voting on the measure excluding EHR specifications until they would bring that back.
Right.
Okay. Any questions, issues? Okay.
The choices are yes, no, or abstain.
Okay.
And Lorian, endorsement?
Well, suitable.
Suitable for endorsement, yes, no, abstain.
So this is suitable for endorsement, divorcing the EHR system?
Correct.
Yes. No.
Christine, suitable for endorsement?
Okay, we have 21 responses. So we have 15 voting yes and 6 voting no.
Okay.
Which is interesting because it passed all 4 categories, you know. So it should have been, but there we have it. That's the nature of steering committees.
Question on that, when we vote the yes, no, do we do it based on majority vote for each of the stops or on our personal vote for each of those, importance, reliability, validity, et cetera?
What's your question?
When we vote whether to endorse the measure, you know, I'll just speak for myself, I voted based on how I had rated the criteria. So, for example, because reliability and validity were low, that would be a non-pass.
That's valid. That's certainly valid. If that's consistent with your assessment of the measure, then that's certainly fine.
Okay, so we don't vote how the majority is voting for each of those.
No.
You know, the majority passed on validity and reliability, but if we didn't personally pass on those, it's okay to say, well, on my rating, they didn't meet the criteria.
Yeah, yes. You're right. That's fine.
Yes, absolutely.
And my comment was that I guess typically we'd seen, you know, that if it passed the other ones, then it would go through more easily. But you certainly should vote, you know, consistent with your assessment of the measure. Okay, I think we've reached lunchtime, haven't we?
Oh, yes.
I think us West Coasters need some protein to proceed. That's right. We need to have a public comment period before we break.
1 second before we rush.
So public and metrics submitters.
Right. So let's go to, is there anyone on the phone that wants
first
to
on the phone. Any public non-metrics submitters who'd like to make comments?
Well, it can also be metrics.
Well, I was going to do first one than the other, but. Or any, okay, anybody else? Yes.
This is Dr. Ashfaq. I'm the clinical development in Amgen. I would like to comment on the sub-10 measure, even though you have voted on that measure, but I would like to comment anyway. We are very concerned about not monitoring this sub-10 measure. I just like to point out the clinical evidence part we discussed here. We have clinical evidence from our registrational trials that Septan decreases the transfusion. That's how the drug came in the market. We also have clinical trial evidence from normal hematocrit study showing the difference in transfusions in patients who were targeted at lower hemoglobin level versus high. We also have very robust government-funded data from USRDS, which is tracking these measures for a long, long time. And I'm just going to give you an example. In 1991, when septan was 60%, the transfusion rates per quarter were 14.4%. When the hemoglobin septan dropped to 5% in 2001, the transfusion rates decreased to 8%. We also have data to suggest that there are other outcomes which may be adverse with associated with hemoglobin less than 10. For example, patient-reported outcomes. We have clinical registrational trial data which suggests that exercise tolerance and physical function is impacted. Both the normal hematocrit data as well as the registrational data is actually present in the modified FDA label which was recently published. We also have abundance of data, LDHR associated data, also including the DOPS data suggesting that hospitalizations increases with hemoglobin less than 10. I think what we are doing is that, the pendulum has swung from the safety on higher end to now on the lower end. And I think we are going to be reactive if we are not going to monitor these sub-10s. We want to be proactive. We would like to continue to monitor hemoglobin less than 10. In the meantime, we should come up with more robust measures which are related to outcomes, including transfusions. And while we are doing this, we should continue to monitor hemoglobins so that when we have those robust measures, which we can couple with the hemoglobins. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments? Yes. You need to get to a microphone, so you can sit down there.
Very quickly, my name is Katie Schubert. I'm the American Society of Pediatric Nephrology's Washington representative, and just wanted to voice ASPN's support for Measure 1667, which is coming up after lunch. While there's limited research on pediatric ESRD patients receiving dialysis having hemoglobin levels less than 10, studies that have been done have shown a 60 to 70% decreased risk for mortality among adolescent patients with hemoglobin greater than 11. Additionally, anemia in children on dialysis and with chronic kidney disease has been found to impact negatively several aspects of health-related quality of life. And this topic has been given a priority nomination for the 2012 Best Pharmaceuticals for Children Act with the National Institute for Child Health and Human Development. And we believe that the target is appropriate for the pediatric and adolescent patient population. More generally, ASPN does see the need for more pediatric ESRD and chronic kidney disease quality measures at both the physician and the facility level. And we support harmonization on analogous measures when that's appropriate. We'll continue to work with the AMA, PCPI, and RPA in the area of physician-level measurement in children, as well as collaborate with CMS on facility-level pediatric measures. And then moving forward with the implementation of the QIP for ESRD facilities, which will include pediatric measures in the future, we believe that NQF endorsement of Measure 1667 may lead to this measure's inclusion in the PQRS, which will further the goal of giving the best quality of care for this pediatric population. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments in the back?
Hi. I'll be brief so you guys can get to your lunch. I'm Lisa McGonigal from Kidney Care Partners, which is a national coalition of patient advocates, healthcare professionals, care providers, and suppliers working together to improve care for patients with chronic kidney disease. We're also the convener of the Kidney Care Quality Alliance, which developed some of the measures that you'll be discussing tomorrow. And we do appreciate this opportunity to comment on the measures that you're considering here today and tomorrow. For the anemia management measures, we wanted to voice our support for Measure 1666. We like to support this for both reporting and payment purposes. KCP's position on the other three anemia management measures is to support them for public reporting only, not for payment. Also on Measure 0252, given the performance gaps between the HD and PD patients that was mentioned previously, if this measure does eventually become endorsed, when implemented, we would recommend that it be reported separately by modality. I'd also like to take 1 minute to comment on this afternoon's session prospectively. For the cardiovascular measures, we support the following measures for public reporting only at 627, 1662, and 1633. We support 1668 lipid profile testing for both public reporting and payment, and we continue our prior opposition to 626 CKD lipid profile monitoring because it's not harmonized with the corresponding PQRI measure and it's not strictly consistent with the KDOQI dyslipidemia guidelines. Finally, for the dialysis adequacy, KCP previously supported the process measures 247, 248, 253, and 254, but we're now recommending that these be retired in the interest of endorsing a parsimonious set and given the availability of corresponding adequacy outcome measures. We support the following dialysis adequacy outcome measures for public reporting and payment, 0318, 0321, 0323. And finally, we previously supported the outcome measures 0249 and 0250, which are the minimum delivered HD dose at greater than 6 months and greater than 90 days. However, we note that the knowledge base has evolved since the measure's initial endorsement in 2008, with recent data suggesting that longer treatment for incident patients might reduce 90-day mortality rates, rendering the residual renal function exclusion unnecessary. We therefore recommend that a single minimal delivered HD dose measure be used, specifically 0249, but that the measure should commence on day one of dialysis rather than at 6 months, and there should not be an exclusion for residual renal function. And we would support this amended measure for both public reporting and payment. Thank you.
Okay, any other comments? Thank you.
Sorry, just one thing. We have submitted a lot of data during the MACAC and CARDEX to support the sub-10, but if the committee is interested, we'll be more than glad to submit it to you, too.
All right. When we come back, we're going to – or should we need to know this right now?
If you would just let Lauren know. Yeah.
Okay. For those who are interested in dinner tonight, it's still open. Open possibility, so let Lauren know. Okay. And
okay. So let's get a well-deserved break for lunch, and we'll obviously we're behind schedule, and we'll see if we can make some time up this afternoon and possibly go a little bit longer than we had planned today. But let's try to get your lunch and reconvene in about 20 minutes so that we can...
So we can do a working lunch. We can eat while we're...
Right.
Okay. So 20 minutes, and we'll try to resume again, which should be quarter to two.
Right.
Thank you. okay, everything okay so far?
Yeah.
Good.
Other than it's just hard to do it.
Okay, I'm going to